This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Literary Treks, our dedicated books and comic show. I am one of the hosts, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as he is always, my friend from a little bit farther north than I am, Dan Gunther.
Hey, Matthew, good to be here again. Excited, as always, to talk about one of my true passions, Star Trek books and comics.
Yeah, you know, I really like both, too. It is definitely a passion of mine. And, you know, one of the exciting things, Dan, is something we haven't got to do in a long time on Literary Treks, and I was thinking about this the other day, we haven't had, I feel like, a lot of news recently.
No, that's very true, yeah.
Yeah. And not only have we not had a lot of news, we haven't had any book covers to judge. Have you noticed that?
I have. It's been, yeah, I don't know how long it's been, but it feels like it's been forever since, you know, we've gotten a chance to judge a book by its cover.
Well, you know what's so exciting? I feel like StarTrek.com was feeling our pain, and they must have realized that that was happening. And plus, you know, when we talked to Kirsten, she said that the book cover was going to be coming out soon for A Pocketful of Lies, and that she had seen it, she liked it. Well, guess what, folks? It is finally here. And Dan, I don't know what to say, so I think you should start us off, because I'm a little bit lost for words here.
Well, Matthew, I mean, I have to be honest. I saw this news break earlier today, and I've just been clicking back to it and looking at it, and it's beautiful. Like, it's really gorgeous. It's really unique, very colorful. I feel like a lot of the covers lately have been depicting something very specific within a book or a specific idea or event. And this one, yeah, it looks very unique to this novel. It's not just another, you know, static shot of Voyager or something like that. It's really, I don't know. Why don't you describe exactly what is on this cover? Because it's just beautiful.
Oh my gosh. This cover has two Voyagers on it. One Voyager on the bottom of the cover and the other Voyager in this like milky mirage at the top. And there seems to be a quite epic, massive explosion type thing in the middle of green light. And then above the Voyager in this, you know, milky reflection is also seems to be some kind of maybe planet as well as a timeline. And Dan, you were mentioning on the other side of the page that you felt like you might know where this timeline came from.
Yeah, Matthew, this looks really familiar. And I wonder if our listeners would remember the Voyager episode Year of Hell, and Anorax had his huge time ship that could erase things from history. And on the back wall of the bridge, there was this graphic that showed the various timelines being skewed with every kind of incursion they made. And these lines that are chasing this mirrored Voyager really, really look like that graphic. So I'm wondering if that's a really big clue as to what this novel's going to deal with.
Well, you also mentioned, Dan, something else about just the blurb we got here. Why will you read that for everybody and then give everybody your thoughts on that? Because you were kind of blowing my mind before. I mean, you were pulling some things out that I just wasn't remembering.
All right, for sure. Well, the blurb goes, The Full Circle fleet has resumed its unprecedented explorations of the Delta Quadrant and former Borg space. Commander Liam O'Donnell of the USS Demeter makes a promising first contact with the Nehydran, humanoid aliens that are collectors of history. They rarely interact with the species they study, but have created a massive database of numerous races, inhabited planets, and the current geopolitical landscape of a large swath of the quadrant. When an exchange of data is proposed via a formal meeting, the Nehydran representatives are visibly shaken when Admiral Catherine Janeway greets them. For almost a century, two local species, the Rilnar and the Zal, have fought for control of the nearby planet Sormana, with both sides claiming it as their ancestral homeworld. The shocking part is that for the last several years, the Rilnar have been steadily gaining ground, thanks to the tactics of their current commanding officer, a human woman who appears to be none other than Catherine Janeway herself. Well, what's really cool about this, Matthew, is the alien races they mention in this blurb, too, they're also from Year of Hell. So I'm really thinking, like, they're kind of minor races in that episode that we don't really see, but they get mentioned. Voyager at one point makes an alliance with the Nehydran and another species whose name I can't remember right now, but... You know, this is all pointing to Year of Hell, so I'm thinking that should maybe be our homework to watch Year of Hell before this novel comes out.
Well, you know, I can't say I'm upset about that, since I think Year of Hell is one of Voyager's absolute best, honestly.
Agreed, yeah.
Except for the ginormous reset button, or should I say explosion crash the ship thing at the end, but still really good, really good. And, honestly, it is an episode of Voyager, that two-parter I can watch just about any time. So the fact that somehow Kirsten might be following up on that with this book and twisting that all together, really getting an insight into how her mind works here and just how much she must watch Voyager to be able to pull all of these very tenuous threads, you know, like Voyager is so much more of anthology piece, like the original Star Trek in some ways. To pull all these things together is really fantastic. So I honestly cannot wait to read this. It's going to be available on January 26th. So I am so looking forward to the opportunity to dive into some more Voyager and, wow. Yeah, Kirsten seems to really be upping her game here. And remember she told us in the interview that the crew was really going to need a vacation after this?
Oh, yeah.
Ah, yeah. This, I don't know, but this sounds like it could get downright mean.
Mm-hmm. One might even say
what could happen here. Yes, nice call, nice call.
And, you know, we know how much of an enemy of the reset button Kirsten Beyer is, so I'm wondering if she's maybe going to undo the biggest reset button in Voyager history. I don't know how, but I'm kind of wondering what she's got up her sleeves for this one.
So, could she be bringing the Krenim back somehow?
Ooh, that would be cool.
Like, yeah. if anybody can find a way, it's Kirsten. So I'm really excited to dive into this one. And we'll put the link in the show notes for everybody so you can check this out at StarTrek.com. It's already on the Babel Conference. I put it there because I just couldn't wait. So hopefully you've checked it out. And man, it really is fantastic. Well, Dan, before we dive in, we've got another great interview. We just keep rolling with the interviews here on Literary Treks. I just feel so blessed. And this week, we've got James Swallow with us to talk about his latest Titan novel, and I can't wait to do that. Before we get into that, we do want to remind everybody that Literary Treks is a part of Trek FM. It's a network that has 20 different shows on it, all devoted to Star Trek and beyond. And that's not Star Trek, that beyond. It's... of course, the 602 Club with everything geeky. We cover every part of Star Trek, behind the scenes, each of the individual shows, books and comics, obviously, here, behind the scenes with the creators of Star Trek and their other work. So you check that out on Commentary Trek Stars. Check that out on Commentary Trek Stars. it's just endless what we have here for you on Trek FM. So go to itunes.com/trekfm. You'll find all the shows there. We're a featured provider in iTunes. You can also check at trek.fm. That is our website, and see all the things that we have for you, all the show pages that we've got for you as well, with all links that we have and information about the different episodes. And of course, we're on Twitter at TrekFM, Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. You can find us on our listeners-only discussion group, which is the Babel Conference. Just type Babel into the search field on Facebook or click discussion on any of the menu bars at Trek.fm, our website. We have the Goodreads group, which allows you to know what we're reading, what's upcoming, what we've already done with the bookshelves, and have discussions with other listeners about what they're reading in the Star Trek universe. And then, of course, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, go to the sidebar on the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. And if you'd like to send us an email, go to trek.fm/contact, choose a show. It'll give you the opportunity to send that to us here at Literary Trek. So we'd love to have that from you. Well, I think, Dan, it's time to dive in and talk to James Swallow.
I'm pretty excited about this interview. This was an excellent novel, and I can't wait to hear what James has to say about it.
Well, Dan, you know, one of the best parts of Literary Treks, and I think we say this all the time, is that we get to talk to the authors. And I have to say that I feel like recently we have just had an incredible run of authors. I mean, Peter David, Kirsten Beyer, we just had David A. Goodman on. I mean, the list just keeps going on, and we get to add to that today.
Definitely. Yeah, we've really had the pleasure of a lot of authors coming through and talking to us. And yeah, especially today's author, James Swallow, one of the best Star Trek novels that I've read this year. So it's definitely a treat to have you on today.
Oh, well, thank you, guys. That's a really nice, and it's always a pleasure to come on the show and chat with you.
Well, James, okay, there have been some different Titan novels that have come out. You know, we've had Absent Enemies, and then we had Titan in Takedown, and, you know, of course, you had worked with Titan in the Fall series. And so, but it feels like it's been a while since, you know, Titan has kind of had a proper Titan novel where it's doing Titan-y things. But a lot has changed for you kind of putting Titan back out on an interesting course. And so I kind of wanted to hear you talk about, now that we're back with just a Titan novel and it's not, you know, being connected to some larger thing, where are we going? You know, we're charting a whole new course. This is a very different, you know, Titan than we've seen before.
Yeah. So this is kind of like, I felt like in a way it's almost like a season break story, is that we had the end of the last season with all the big events that were taking place in the fall. And then you have the events of Absent Enemies and Takedown kind of ramping that up and, you know, getting your nice kind of coda to that sort of story. And this was very much with Sight Unseen, was, you know, we're moving into a new phase, a new season of stories. And to begin with, initially, you know, I had a conversation with my editor, Margaret Clark, and I said, well, look, how are we going to do this? Are we going to just send the Titan back to where they were? Are they going to go back to the outpost, you know, the Gum Nebula, and, you know, back to where we'd seen them exploring in, you know, deep, deep space? Or are we going to do something different? And I was all for, you know, taking them back to where they'd been. And Margaret said to me, you know, we have to reflect that change. We have to make sure that, you know, we can't just kind of reset things. We have to make things different. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that, you know, she was making a very good point there. So I wanted to try and get back to the classic sort of style of the, you know, the strange new worlds, new life, new civilizations, exploratory feel that the early Titan books had, but not by taking them back to where they'd been before. And it kind of put me in this position where I'm being kind of pulled in two different directions, because, you know, I want to give Titan stories where they can explore strange new worlds, but also I don't want to send them out so far away that they can't come back and have stories where they can connect with the Federation and other sort of ships and crews. So I went back to TOS, you know, because one of the original ideas for Titan was it was supposed to be TOS style story in a TNG world. And of course, if you look at the original series, you know, they do strike the balance between those stories of exploration and the stories where they go back to the Federation. And that was very much in my thoughts when I was putting together Sight Unseen. So it's kind of a book of two halves, I think, in a way. You know, the book opens up with the kind of setting out the table and saying, okay, this is the changed situation that these characters are in. And there are a few changes, you know, people get promotions and positions get changed around, new characters are introduced. And then the second half of the story is them going out and, you know, coming across an alien species and facing a new threat. And that's kind of like setting out the mission statement for what will hopefully be a new season of Titan stories.
Well, and that's, I think what's really cool about it is that it's giving us a new opportunity and a new way to explore these characters, and opening up a lot of different doors. And that's really cool because, you know, we'd obviously seen a lot of just the base exploration for Titan, but now it's not just the exploration for Titan, but it's really also getting to really dive deep into the characters as exploration as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been part of what Titan is there's the kind of ongoing, for want of a better term, kind of soap opera of the lives of these characters, you know, and the trials and tribulations that they go through in their personal lives, as well as the sort of the larger question of, you know, the exciting stories that the characters get involved in. And that was very much something that I wanted to play with in this story. So, you know, there is a kind of C story in here, which is about some of the characters, you know, saying, well, you know, this is my personal circumstances and these circumstances are changing and I'm going off in a different direction. Something that I'm very fond of as a writer is mirroring in stories, is having a kind of micro story and a macro story and having each story reflect an element of the other, even if they are about completely different things. When you drill down, the idea of the story is the same. And I think that's very much going on all through all of the subplots. In Sight Unseen, it's characters being put in new circumstances and having to deal with those circumstances. And then at the end of those stories saying, well, okay, I'm going in a new direction now.
You know, two of those characters that and character arcs that really are changing and growing are Riker and Vale. And, you know, they have some things to get used to that they weren't necessarily thinking were coming just yet. I mean, Riker obviously still dealing with his promotion to being an admiral and trying not to be a badmiral.
Yeah.
which, great reference there.
Love that term was in there. That was great.
And, you know, Vale has always wanted to be a captain, but I don't think that she quite thought this was what it was going to be like.
Yeah, and I totally wanted to do that. That's, you know, the thing that Riker goes through in Poison Chalice, which is where, you know, kind of, right, you're an admiral now. And he's like, wait, what? You know, and he doesn't get a chance to sort of think about how he's going to deal with it. In a way, he kind of forces Vale to go through the similar situation where he says, you know, you wanted to be captain of the ship. Well, now you are, and you've got to deal with it. And it's the thing that she's always wanted, but she didn't want it like this. And there's a, you know, some of the events that take place through the story put her right at the sharp end of what it means to be a commanding officer and sending people into harm's way. And she has to deal with it. And she doesn't really get time to think about it. And I think what really attracted me to the idea of putting those two characters in that situation is it takes a relationship that we've already seen and developed, which is Riker as the commander and Vale as the first officer. And it puts them in a completely new situation. Where it's still, you know, he's in charge of her and she's a lower ranking officer. But now the power dynamic has changed because it's Vale's ship. And so, you know, technically she has the last word, but Riker is on board that vessel and he's using it as his kind of mobile center of operations in his new role as a kind of admiral of the sector. And new tensions are coming up. And I think what I found was interesting was the idea of looking at Riker and thinking, well, now he's no longer thinking about a crew of, you know, 1,000-odd people on board a starship. Now he's thinking about an entire sector of space. So he's got to be a big picture guy. But there's Vale. And now Vale is thinking, well, this ship is now my family. This is my primary consideration. And that's going to bring them into conflict. And that's exactly what happens in this story.
Well, and Riker is also thinking about his own family, who's on the ship, and that complicates things even more.
Yeah, I mean, there's all of that stuff going on there as well. As you know, the situation with Riker and Deanna and their daughter Natasha, you know, you've got all of the family issues there. Is how would you deal with that if, you know, your family's in harm's way? Especially as well, you know, Deanna's not a stay-at-home mum. You know, she's got all of her sort of situations to deal with as well. You know, she's busy with her own set of issues and sort of adventures that she's going on. So it is, you know, it's very much a kind of a multi-layered sort of thing. But what attracted me was the idea of looking at the classic Star Trek Badmiral character, you know, is a guy who comes in, throws his weight around, right? You can't do this, you can't do that. And the captain says, bah, you don't know what it's like being out of the sharp end. You don't have any experience of that sort of thing. You know, you're just some guy who warms a desk, you know? And of course, we know that's not true with Riker, because we've seen Riker mm-hmm. go through the sharp end of things. But now Riker is saying to himself, I've got to be that guy. I've got to be that guy with the big picture view. I can't think like a captain anymore. And Vale is in the opposite situation, where she's like, now I do have to think like a captain. And I think that's interesting, to put two people who were very simpatico into a situation where they now have, they're still those people, but now they have to think differently. And that may bring them into situations where friction gets generated between the two of them. And that's where great drama happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really loved the parts where you kind of used that. And even in the very beginning, Riker's very cognizant of it when the Dynak ask him to bring the ship home immediately. And Riker's basically thinking, well, you know, if I was the captain, I'd probably chafe against this order too. But, you know, now I've got a bigger picture to look at. I've got to worry about the relationship between the Federation and these people. And it just really shows that his scope of the issues he deals with is a lot larger than it was before.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting place to put a character. I mean, it's not something I think we've really seen. Maybe, I guess, if you look at the Vanguard novels and you look at the character of Diego Reyes, you know, a guy who was in charge of a starbase, who had a bigger remit than just one starship, you see some similarities there. And I think that's an interesting place to put a character like Riker in. It's like, okay, man, you know, you're flying a desk. And he's like, well, I'm not going to fly a desk. I'm going to do it my way. You know, so he's found a way to fly a desk and still be on board a starship. And that's just the kind of thing that Riker would do, because he's the guy who finds a different way around things. You know, that very much that kind of Kirkian sort of attitude that he puts out there. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that will continue to be interesting and continue to put him into interesting circumstances as we move forward. You know, I didn't want to do the thing that, you know, that we see with Kirk, is that Kirk gets to be an admiral for a while, and after a while he gets bored with it and we go back to him being a captain again. I'm not saying that that won't happen with Riker. You know, maybe in future books the decision might be made to sort of put him back on in the command chair. But I think for now, I'm interested in exploring how that being an admiral stuff is going to work on him as a character.
Well, and I was thinking back when you talked about Reyes from Vanguard, I was also thinking about, because I've always felt like Sisko is admiral material, because he's already proved big picture thinking from his time on Deep Space Nine, worrying about the Bajoran sector, and then, of course, helping run a war with Admiral Ross and help win a war. So, you know, that too was in my mindset, is that Riker's having to make that transition from, you know, smaller thinking like you were talking about to, yeah, we're talking about the entire Alpha Quadrant Federation. That's Riker's bag now.
Yeah, I mean,
so it's all about the belt buckle.
It's interesting you bring up Sisko's situation, because, you know, he kind of starts off, even though, you know, at the beginning of the DS9 he's a commander, but he starts off as a guy who has to have that bigger picture thinking, because he's, you know, he's on the starbase and he's not in charge of just a ship. He's essentially in charge of like an entire solar system's worth of issues and problems. And then as the show unfolds, you know, in later seasons, he becomes a captain of Defiant, and his focus changes. It kind of narrows down a little bit more, even though he has that sort of larger stuff going on, you know, the larger issues of the war, and also his personal situation as the emissary and all those kind of things. And that, again, I think is a cool exploration of what the kind of differing levels of responsibility do to a person. And I find that interesting. And as Riker is, as I've always said, you know, Riker is one of my favorite characters on Star Trek. And I like the idea of putting him through that and seeing how he responds to it.
I did want to ask about the new character that you brought on board the Titan from the Enterprise episode North Star, which I love that somebody was referencing Enterprise and an episode that I actually kind of really enjoyed, North Star, because it was so strange and just out of the blue in season three. But I, not only that, but Ethan, to me, it almost felt like I had tripped back in some ways, but on board the Titan. So I'm going to love you forever for bringing that feeling back to Star Trek, that old Southern, you know, good old boy. I love it. So just talk about kind of adding that kind of dynamic into something like the strange dynamic that is the Titan anyway.
Well, I wanted to introduce some new characters in this novel. And I wanted to pick somebody who is kind of, you know, a mid-level kind of character who could get into trouble and you know, wasn't necessarily wearing plot armor, you know, who could, you know, turn up in the story and maybe get killed and there'd still be some sort of like, you know, jeopardy about him. And I went through a lot of different ideas. You know, I was going through all of the different sort of Star Trek species and I was thinking, well, I don't want it to be just an ordinary plain vanilla human. I want to make it a little bit different, but not too kind of crazy wild alien so people couldn't empathize with it. And I've always been a huge fan of Westerns. And I love North Star as an episode because it kind of, to me, it harks back to the, you know, the Planet of the Hats type trope of like, you know, from the original series, or it's Planet of it's Planet of the People from who are Nazis. It's Planet of the Chicago 1920s, right? It's Planet of the Romans. And so the idea that there would be Planet of the Cowboys, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. And so, you know, when that episode ends, you don't really hear any more about the sort of circumstance that they were in. And I was thinking, okay, well, you know, how would that evolve? Here we are, you know, decades later, and would that culture still exist, or would it have been flattened out? And I just liked the idea that there was this planet out there that North Star in the sort of current era had evolved, and the two factions had, you know, made their peace, but they'd kept that sort of Western flavor, because I just think that's really cool. So I decided, right, okay, Ethan Kaizak, he's going to be that guy. And I wanted to do that kind of, you know, that kind of down home, good old boy kind of thing going on there. You know, he has that sort of easy kind of farm boy charm, but there's a little bit more going on underneath it, you know. And he has a secret, you know, that I'm not going to reveal for a while yet, that kind of marbles his character, is the reason why he's actually on the ship is, you know, he's running from something. And maybe in future stories, you know, that what that is will come to the fore. And I just found that as I started to put the character together, he almost wrote himself. So I tried to make him, you know, all of the things that makes that kind of character fun, but also chuck some stuff in there as well that doesn't make him, he's not a complete stereotype, you know. He's not everything you would expect from sort of, you know, the quintessential space cowboy. But there is a little bit of that stuff going in there as well.
Well, speaking of characters who have secrets, of course, the other new character you introduce is Commander Sarai, who I thought was very fascinating and brings a really interesting dynamic. And of course, at the very end, her big secret is kind of revealed to the audience, but of course not to the rest of the Titan crew. Talk a little bit about kind of the genesis of that character and bringing that dynamic into the story.
Well, Sarai was a minor bit plot character that we had in the Fall series. And she was somebody who had fallen into line with Ishan Anjar and his plans for this kind of, you know, hawkish federation that was much more militaristic. And I think I'd done a few little bits and pieces of stuff with her, but it was Dave Mack who'd done the most with her in his novel. And I can remember chatting to him about her and saying, you know, I'm thinking about introducing this new character as the first officer for the ship. And I'd been looking around saying, who have we got who's just kind of lying around, who hadn't been used, who I could put in? And I came across Sarai and I thought, she's perfect, because immediately anybody who's read The Fall will characterize her as a bad guy. And I thought, that to me is interesting, is if I take that character and put them on the bridge of the ship in a command position, they've immediately got a lot of baggage to deal with because of the fallout from The Fall, you know, how all the other characters on the ship are going to deal with it. All of the readers are going to come to it with baggage, with kind of preconceptions about who she is. And that to me is fun, because I can play with those preconceptions and, you know, maybe prove some of them true and then prove that, you know, some of them aren't, that you don't have the full story. And Dave had done a really good job just kind of setting her up with all this backstory. And I remember I called him and I said to him, look, how are you planning to run this? Are you going to do some stuff with this character in one of your novels? And he said, I hadn't really thought about it. So he basically, you know, gave me his approval to take it on. And he was saying when he wrote her in the first scene, when she appears, a lot of the backstory stuff, he said, just kind of came out of the ether as he was writing it. You know, it wasn't planned. It was just like, oh, this makes sense that, you know, she had this, you know, event that took place in her past, and that, you know, that she'd been in Starfleet intelligence, and that she, you know, had a captain's mast and been, you know, put up in front of a tribunal for events that had taken place. So she was carrying this kind of dark event in her past. And all of that to me is great grist for the character Mill. So I wanted to take this character who has this massive chip on their shoulder about what's happened to them, and put them on the bridge of Titan, where everybody on Titan knows each other very, very well, and they're all like, you know, a well-oiled machine, and then just throw somebody into that group who no one likes and say, you have to work together, and then force them into a situation where, you know, they have to do what they do. And Sarai just, you know, she came together really well. I mean, she's just like kind of unrepentantly who she is. And if you don't like her, she does not give a damn. It's all about, you know, I want to get the job done. And, you know, I'm, you know, this kind of like, you know, this ice queen sort of character. She's very cold and unfeeling. But of course, that's not really all she is. You know, she does have, there's more going on underneath that. And maybe we're not seeing who she is right now. But there's a lot of, she has an interesting road to go down, I think. And that's what I find interesting about her, is she's a character you can put into a situation, and every scene she's going to be in, she will grow and change for the reader. We don't know that much about her. So there's a lot of places that she can go. And I like that about the character.
Well, and super spoiler alert for everyone here, because I'm going to talk about the very end of the book with James here. You give this mystery that she's on the ship to watch Riker and Vale, and we don't know exactly who she's reporting to. We can only speculate, but man, it's adding another layer to, is she reporting to somebody in Starfleet? Is it who, what is going on here? And are we going to, has Starfleet not learned its lesson yet?
Or is something else going on? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you have opened up a serious can of worms, my friend.
Well, that's exactly the point of it, you know, is that, I mean, through the course of Sight Unseen, you know, Sarai does grow as a character. You know, she does, some of the rougher edges do get softened. Not a lot, just a little. But I wanted to show her, you know, as somebody who's, you know, she's all about her duty. And that's what that scene is about, is that, you know, she has this clandestine mission while she's on the ship, is not only to do the job that she's there to do, which is be first officer, but she's also reporting to somebody. And that kind of spun out to me of the idea that when the events of the fall kind of coagulated and everything started to kind of go back to normal, you know, there would be people inside and outside Starfleet who would not be happy with the way that the chips fell. And I think there's even a moment where Vale is thinking about, why was I given Sarai? You know, why didn't I get the opportunity to choose my own first officer? Because the hint is there, is that she probably would have promoted Tuvok up to the mm-hmm. position of first officer. And I think she kind of looks upon this and says, well, maybe it's because of all the things that we've did, all the times that we kind of pulled on our leash a little too hard. And now maybe this is somebody kind of saying, we're watching you, you know, we put this person on your ship, and if we hadn't put this person on the ship, maybe you would not be captain. Maybe you would be in a much more unpleasant situation. And I think Sarai in some ways is a kind of an indicator for the other characters, is like, not to, you know, you watch what you're doing, because there's somebody on the ship who's keeping an eye on you.
It reminds me of two different things. One is the political situation in Star Trek VI, where there is a, you know, a faction of Starfleet that obviously doesn't want peace with the Klingons. But then at the same time, Sarai also kind of reminds me of like The Hunt for October, with the political officer that you would have to have on a ship when, you know, you're in the Russian Navy or any part of the military, you would have that loyalty officer almost. And that's the other thing she reminds me of. And it's like a scary thought that Starfleet has introduced, you know, loyalty officers into the ranks, at least here on Titan.
Yeah, there is a little bit of that stuff going on. I mean, Hunt for Red October is one of my favorite novels, you know, and I've always liked the idea of the political officer. And in a way, I've always thought that that's kind of like the job the diplomatic officer or the ship's counselor performed, you know, which was, you know, like a morale officer making sure everybody's happy, whereas a political officer kind of like, you know, is a little bit more serious about making you toe the line, you know, and mm-hmm. making sure that you salute the right way and sing the right, you know, national anthem or that kind of thing. But yeah, I think that all of that is stuff that falls out of the fact that what we're dealing with in the Federation now in the novels is a post-war society, is that we've gone from this massive Borg invasion and then the, you know, the shakeup of the fall. And you have this generation of people who've grown up in the ashes of that and are now kind of pulling themselves out of it. And you have that generation plus the generation that's, you know, experienced that and all the stuff that's come before. And there is tension between the two of them. And the society is trying to sort of find a new equilibrium. And of course, on top of all of that, they've got all the pressures from the outside as well, from the Typhon Pact and other species. And then the new enemy that gets introduced in this book as well is they've got a lot of outside influences acting on them. And, you know, that's a difficult sort of map for them all to navigate. And again, you know, that's where great drama comes out. You put characters under pressure and you see what pops out of it.
Reminds me of the great Billy Joel song.
Well, one thing in this novel, and something that the Starfleet characters really exemplify, I think, and a lot of the characters have learned, but not all of them, is that people are stronger together. So, you know, the Titan crew, the Dynak at the end realize this, and the rebel Solane, whose name escapes me at the moment, they take that message to heart, but the Solane are just really do not. And the sad part to me was that they could be helped by the Federation, but because of their xenophobia and their basically extreme superiority complex, they've ensured that that won't happen. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the mindset of the Solane and kind of the juxtaposition between them and the Federation characters.
Well, you know, that scene at the ending is it's a Star Trek scene that we've seen a bunch of times, which is mm-hmm. where, you know, our characters have encountered an alien race and they've had a bit of a dust up and then they kind of say, well, here's the olive branch, you know, and maybe if we can kind of have a conversation, if we can just put our hands off our guns for 5 minutes and maybe we can do something good. And most of the time, because Star Trek is, you know, an uplifting and generally a positive kind of situation, is the answer is usually, well, okay, we'll give it a go. And that kind of happens in this book with some of the characters. But with the Solane, I thought, just for once, let's have them meet somebody who says, you know what? And they throw the olive branch back in their face and say, you know what? No, we hate you and we want to fight you. And you know, and like you say, they are aggressive and superior and they see... You know, it's a society that's evolved to such a situation where they don't see other people as their equals. And, you know, sad to say, there are societies like that in the real world. And I think, you know, part of Star Trek's job has always been to kind of hold this mirror up to the real world. So I wanted to show a little bit of that, is what happens if you come across somebody who has extreme views that are so embedded that you have to confront the reality that, you know what, you can't change everybody's point of view. You can't bring everybody around. And sometimes you have to say, you know, well, okay, if that's the way it's going to be, then okay, you know, and but if you, you know, you and if you attack us, we're going to have to defend ourselves. And that's the situation that, you know, the Riker kind of lays it out and says, well, you know, we gave you the chance. And, you know, next time, you know, if you come at us, we may not offer it to you again. But that's leavened by the fact that we have the situation with the Dinak and the Siari, who are the kind of the splinter faction. And they are two species who, you know, are very much on opposing sides. And by the intervention of the Federation characters and by the experiences that everybody has, is they get to an opportunity where they say, look, we can make peace here. We can work together. And so there is some sort of hope, even though in this other situation, you know, things didn't go well.
Well, and I liked that you did that with the Solane. And because it was a reminder that, you know, Star Trek, as you said, it has this goal of pointing us and pointing out things that we need to remember and need to be cognizant of that are in our world and have been in our world. And, you know, the Solane were a reminder of the worst, like, terror worst regimes that we've ever had and the things that still go on in our world, you know, of seeing somebody as, you know, less than human, even though they see them as less than Solani. So you can do whatever you want to them because they're not a being worth, you know, saving or even talking to, you know? So it's just a lower form of being, or heck, you can just change the name and you can rationalize terrible, terrible things. And I felt like that was such an important message, even in today's world, because that happens all the time.
It's totally that. It's the, you know, what the Solani are doing is, you know, the process of othering, you know, is that they're looking at anyone who's not them and saying, you are less than us. You know, you are worthless. And therefore, as you say, we can do whatever we like, you know, horrible, terrible things, unconscionable things, because, you know, we have made this kind of mental distinction that, you know, you are less than us. And therefore, as we see it, it's not a problem for us to behave in these terrible, terrible ways. And they're justifying it by saying, well, you know, we're doing this in order to save our civilization, even though in the course of the story, Riker says, you know, you don't have to do it this way. We'll help you find a different way. But it's so embedded in their culture that they won't do it. And they've even, you know, to the point that they've hunted down people who don't agree with them amongst their own species and tried to eradicate that kind of view. And I think that that's, you know, as you say, it is something that sadly we do see in the real world. But I think it also puts our characters in an interesting circumstance to have to deal with that kind of extremity of view in a way that is intelligent and reasoned and decent.
Yeah, I think one of the most terrifying things in the book that I read was when they were asked, why are you doing this? Why do you do this? And the answer basically was, because we can and we don't care.
I mean, you know, if you go back to the original episode with the Solani, you know, schisms, that's a very dark, scary, haunted house of a story, you know, and it deals with the, you know, it's the alien abduction episode, right? And it's and that stuff is just, man, super creepy. And so I wanted to, you know, tap back into some of that kind of element, you know, but also touch on a bunch of other questions about, like, you know, what would motivate a species to do that to somebody else, but also to touch in on the questions about how it affects people who've had that happen to them. If you look at the characters of Riker and Rager in the course of this story, is, you know, they're the two characters on board the ship who had that experience back in the day on board the Enterprise, and they're both still carrying it around with them, and it colors their point of view. You know, from Rager's point of view, it's something that, you know, almost forced her out of Starfleet because it was so traumatic. Mm-hmm. And for Riker, it's something that he's kind of put away in a box, and he thought, oh, I've dealt with this, but he realizes that he really didn't. And it's, you know, it becomes more terrifying for him because this threat reappears, and at this time it takes his wife and daughter, you know. And so it's, for any sort of father and husband, a terrible sort of situation to come across. And I like the idea of putting him in a situation where, you know, he comes across a group of what he thinks are the beings who have abducted his family, and his first reaction is an aggressive one. Mm-hmm. And that's not actually the right reaction, because it turns out the people he's talking to are not the people who did this. You know, and that's very much the salient lesson of, like, you know, just because a dog bites you, not every dog will bite you. Mm-hmm. But you have to be careful to, you know, is this a dog that's going to bite me, or is it a different kind of dog? You know, and it's that circumstance is interesting to put a character like Riker in, because his emotions are very close to the surface, you know, and I thought it was believable that he would react strongly to this kind of situation. But also, you know, he's the kind of guy who has the ability to grow and change and accept things that other people might find difficult. And that's kind of his arc through the course of this novel.
It also brings up for me, especially with the Solani characters, this idea of, you know, what would you do to survive? And when that is your only thought process, what will you rationalize, and where will that bring you? You know, when you're living only purely for yourself and survival, and it will bring you to very, very terrible places, as we see, like, your whole means of existence becomes making use of others and putting down anything that stands in your way, because nothing else matters but you. And that is another, I mean, it's a great logical extreme for people, I think, to be able to see of a life lived not together, but just with your one group.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing about, I've always thought that the true interesting things about characters who are quote unquote bad guys is that nobody wakes up in the morning and says, you know, today I will eat a baby and set fire to kittens, right? You know, today I will be a villain. It's most people who are villainous in fiction and in the real world believe that they are doing the right thing. And believe they are doing it for right reasons. And you can look at the Solani and say, well, you know, they have a good reason for this, is that they're trying to preserve their entire culture. And who would not want to do that? But it's the number of lines they've crossed to get to where they are. Is, you know, little by little, they've made all of these decisions which have pushed them further and further away from being decent people into making choices that hurt others, to the point that they don't even see it as a problem anymore. They've gone so far, they can't even see the line they've crossed. They're so far away from it.
The line is a dot to you.
Yeah, you know, it's like, you know, the other characters can say, well, you know, look over your shoulder, that thing, that little dot far, far away from you, that's the line you crossed. And you've crossed every line since, and now you don't even realize that you're doing it with every choice that you make. And that I find interesting. And, you know, we have with the dissident characters, you know, we have the people from the same species who are aware of that, who have looked at it and gone, what are we doing? You know, let's put the brakes on. Let's try and reverse the circumstance.
Well, and for them too, the Solani, they're doing what's convenient for them, you know, because it would be so much harder to deal with actual change. You know, to do something different, to do the hard thing. You know, they're doing what's convenient, and we do tons of terrible things in our world for the sake of convenience. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very much so. It's, you know, here's a culture who has, you know, they are offered an olive branch, but in order to accept that, it would mean they have to change who they are. They have to change the way they see the universe, and they're just not willing to do that. And they'd rather go the hard way. You know, they'd rather be bloody minded about it. And that may, as you know, as Riker says, that may end up being the, you know, the death sentence for your species because you couldn't change. And I think that's a very Star Trek lesson to put out there, to say, like, you know, if you're not willing to embrace change, if you're afraid of things that are unlike you, and if you allow that to rule you, eventually, you know, that's going to destroy you.
I loved the fact that Dan touched on this, that there is this horror aspect that you really tapped into. So I thought it was a perfect book to be reading here in October, great Halloween. Yeah. But talk about kind of, you know, you had a great mix of this kind of sci-fi horror. You know, obviously you said Schisms, it was a really creepy episode, but talk about ratcheting up that tension in this book and kind of creating that horror aspect for Star Trek.
Well, you know, there's the germ of a story pitch that I put together for Voyager many, many years ago. I always thought was a really cool story idea that I never got to sell. And I remember kicking it around at some of the story meetings, and everybody said, like, yeah, we really, really like this, but we couldn't find a way to make it work. And that was, you remember the shower scene in Psycho?
Yes,
you take, like, you know, a perfectly ordinary thing and you make it this kind of crucible of terror, you know? So you see that movie, and then next time you get in a shower, I defy anybody not to watch that movie, pull the curtain back, and just for a second think about seeing a shadow of some scumbag with a butcher knife, right? And yet it's this common or garden thing that just exists in all of our homes. And I was thinking, well, what's the Star Trek equivalent of that thing? And I thought, the replicator. Mm. Everybody's house in Star Trek, every room you see in Star Trek has got a replicator in it. And it's just this ordinary thing that you go to and you get your cup of tea, Earl Grey hot, you know, and your Jum Jar stick or whatever it is you want out of your replicator. And I thought, well, what if that could be perverted in some kind of way? You know, it comes down to the kind of, you know, the killer's inside the house already. You know, the idea that this thing that you think is ordinary suddenly becomes a conduit for terrible stuff to happen. And so there is this whole sequence where, you know, the ship's replicators are turned against the crew, this common ordinary thing, and it becomes very, very creepy. And all of the characters have to deal with this situation that's like kind of spiraling out of control. So that was kind of where that came from. And also the idea of turning the Enterprise a little bit into the sort of haunted house itself by, you know, making the ship lose power, and it's adrift, and everybody's separated, and you have all these different characters in different parts of the ship who can't communicate, who don't know what's going on, having to deal with, you know, this threat that is, you know, in danger of basically taking over and destroying the entire vessel. And that was fun to do, just, you know, to do the whole kind of spook house kind of thing with the Enterprise, have the characters dealing with what to them is familiar territory being turned into the unfamiliar and the scary.
That's such a fun thing. And I just love that, you know, we're here in October, at least when we're talking and recording when the book came out, and it's just a perfect like Halloween book for Star Trek to have at this point.
I guess it's kind of like, you know, imagine in your own circumstance, if you were locked in your house, all the windows were blacked out and your toaster started attacking you, right? That's what's going on to the people on board the ship, right?
Toaster of death.
You can hear it coming up coming up the stairs. It's coming after you. You can smell the bread cooking. It's coming up.
Yeah, and that was terrifying, kind of that realization on the bridge that like every single crewman's quarters has a replicator in it and they're just spewing out these creatures. That was, I remember thinking, reading at that point, like, how are they going to overcome this? Like, that's just like, if I were a junior officer on the bridge, I'd be like, well, I'm heading for an escape pod. Good luck, everyone.
That's it. We're screwed. Yeah. Yeah. That was it was a fun idea, and it came out really, really well. And I think it just, sometimes you have an idea and you can't find the right place for it. And that was, you know, I pitched it for Voyager all those years ago, but like any other writer will tell you, you know, never throw any ideas away, always keep them. And I knew somewhere I would find the right place for it. And then when I was writing this story, I was like, oh, this is it. This is how it dovetails with this narrative. And it fits nicely with the whole kind of the creepy vibe of the, you know, the Schisms storyline and the Solana, you know, touching on again, and that whole creepy alien abduction sort of thing. You know, I was looking at movies like Fire in the Sky, Close Encounters a little bit, and also Communion, you know, all have that sort of very spooky alien abduction thing going on. I wanted to get that vibe, because, you know, when you talk about alien abduction ideas, it's like, well, this is very much a kind of idea that's rooted in the real world in the present day. It's like, you know, we're talking about characters who fly around in space and meet aliens all the time. So for them, it wouldn't be weird. So, but how do you make it creepy? How do you make it scary? Yeah. And I always felt like Schisms was a really cool idea for an episode, kind of let down a bit by the kind of space fish monks that they did. And, you know, I think if you read the Larry Nemechek's TNG companion, he talks a little bit about that story. And he said how, you know, that it perhaps wasn't shot in a way that made it look as scary as it could be. But I think that there was definitely the germ of a very cool idea there. And they always said they were going to bring those guys back, and they never found a way to do it. So I thought, this is a good opportunity to bring these characters back. And it also dovetails nicely with the place that the characters are in at the beginning of the story, which is dealing with these new circumstances. And then suddenly we throw in this threat from the past, which kind of throws all of that into sharp relief.
That's something that I noticed, you know, that recently with Titan, they've been dealing with some old TNG nemesises. You know, the same thing happened in Takedown as well. For you, I'd love to kind of hear about the idea of bringing back things, and how do you balance that with the new things you create and bringing back old things and making it feel organic and not like, oh, they're just, you know, running out of ideas or something like that?
Sure. Well, there's that kind of, you know, Trek nerd kind of impulse where you kind of go, oh, those were really cool, I'd love to see those guys again. And it's, but you don't want to keep doing the equivalent of like a greatest hits collection, right? You know, here's the same song you heard before, just played slightly differently. You know, you don't want to do a cover version of the same story. So the key thing is to sort of take that idea. I mean, you know, you talk about Takedown as a good example of it as well. Is he doing the John Jackson Miller, they're doing exactly the same kind of thing, I think, coming from the same place as me. Is saying, okay, take this idea that was a great story that left this door open and say, well, let's go back to that place and let's explore some of that, but let's do something new with it. That's the key thing, is like, you know, open it out. Don't do the same thing again. Bring something new to it, and then leaven that with some new story elements as well. So it's not like you're doing the same thing all over again. It's like, you know, so you shine a different light on the existing element, but you add something new to it, that you broaden it out.
And I think, yeah, that's something that when you're working with even the characters, that was something that it's like you got to keep giving them something that helps them continue to grow. And that's one of the things that I love about the continuity that we get in the books like this, is that we're watching the progression of the characters that we loved watching originally, but they're not just stuck in the same place.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because, you know, you look at the first, when you look at Schisms, that story is about the characters on the Enterprise being confronted with a strange mystery that they can't understand. And by the end of the episode, they understand that this weird thing is going on. In Sight Unseen, what you have is characters being confronted by a strange mystery and then understanding that it's something they've encountered before, but it's completely different from what their experiences were. And so they think, oh, we know what this problem is. We know how to deal with it. And of course the kicker is actually, no, you don't. This is completely different from what you thought it was. And things are turned around. And it, and so it challenges not only the preconceptions of the characters, but hopefully the preconceptions of the readers, who will go, oh, it's these species. I know how that's going to work out. It's like, no, no, actually it's coming from a completely different direction. So you're carried hopefully towards a conclusion that you aren't expecting when you start reading the book.
You have been, you know, kind of working with Titan for a while now, and I know you have a great love for Riker as a character. And I was kind of wondering, you know, being with these, you know, this crew and these characters so long, what are some of the things that have been the most, you know, like personal for you writing these characters and getting the opportunity to continue to explore them, and some of the ones that have really surprised you even?
Well, that's a really great question. I love the Rikers as a family unit. I think that's really interesting to play around with that and explore some of the issues that came from that. I mean, the first Titan novel I did, Synthesis, ended up being a book about parenting, really, which is something that I haven't experienced in my own life, but it's something I'm fascinated by. And I think as a writer and as a human being and as James Swallow, you know, I got to get in touch with maybe my inner dad in a little way by, you know, by writing that stuff about Riker. And so that was a fun experience for me. I love the ensemble of the characters. You know, we've got all these really, really great characters, and we have, and as writers, we've got a great opportunity to bring new characters in and to shake things up a bit. And we don't have to be worrying about our effects budget, you know. So if we have a character who looks like a kind of set of wind chimes or a lava lamp, you know, we can have a character who looks like it. We can have a giant lobster guy, or, you know, as it doesn't just have to be a guy with a some lumpy forehead makeup, you know. And once we get into all those ideas about strange alien species and how they interact with species who are like us, that's fascinating to write about. And to me, it feels very Star Trek. Is, you know, the idea of Titan being this microcosm of the Federation, is that the most species diverse ship in the entire Federation, and that it's almost, you know, I think I have Riker say this in articulating it in a speech he gives at the beginning of the book, where he says how Titan is almost like the exemplar of that ideal. And that you could park that starship in orbit around any planet and say, you know what the Federation is? It's this. These people. Come and look around this ship. Come and see how all these different disparate groups from different worlds all work together. This is what the United Federation of Planets is. And I love that ideal. And that's, to me, feels like it's something that's the very core of Star Trek, that ideal marbles the entire saga for every single series. And Titan, you know, puts that front and center, and that is really, really fun to write. I never get tired of that idea.
Well, with this novel, you've set up a lot of new elements for Titan going forward, and I'm just curious, where do you see Titan going from here, and will you get an opportunity to chart that course?
Another good question. Well, you know, when I finished writing this, one of the things I did for myself is I kind of made up a bunch of notes, a sort of direction document for, you know, what I think would be interesting, and, you know, a few ideas about, well, maybe I could do this and maybe I could do that. I mean, you know, I haven't been commissioned to write another Titan novel yet. I don't know if another author is going to be brought in, you know, because it is a multi-author series, and it may be somebody else who picks up the next story. I certainly do have some ideas. In fact, in the last sort of couple of weeks, when this is the kind of thing that always happens, is I'm working on one particular project and ideas for a completely different project will start buzzing around inside my head and taking up all my brain space. And I have been thinking about an idea for another Titan novel. So I'm just kicking that around so far. I don't have the whole thing yet, but I have an idea about what I'd like to do next. And I think there are a lot of interesting places to go. You know, like I say, I've put them close to the Federation, but not too close. So we can still do, we've still got the whole kind of toolkit of stories that we can do. So we can do weird alien stuff. We can do Strange New Worlds. We can do a story where the characters can come back to Earth if they need to, or to a, you know, a planet that we're familiar with. And I think that's a great place to put them in, because it gives them a lot of opportunities and a lot of possible avenues to travel down.
Well, you have been working, I know, on some really cool things. And so everybody obviously needs to go out and get a copy of this, because it's a great book. But I wanted you to be able to share the other things that you've been working on, what's out there. I mean, you've been doing some really fun things with, you've been working with Disney Infinity and their Star Wars property. So yeah, tell everybody about the other things that you've been working on and things that they can find out there and what's coming up next for James.
Well, the Star Wars stuff, that's been an absolute blast. I mean, you know, as a sort of 40 something nerd, obviously I am a child of the Star Wars generation, and I've always wanted to write something officially Star Wars. You know, I've worked on some licensed magazines and publications back in the day, but I've never got an opportunity to write, you know, fiction for the Star Wars universe. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Disney Infinity, it's basically everything that Disney owns. Every different world, so Marvel Comics, Star Wars, and all of the Disney characters. It's a game, for a family game, that enables you to get these characters, these kind of toy figures that you place on a little platform, and they appear in a video game, and you can play through these narrative play sets. And you also have this kind of digital Lego kind of Minecraft style system where you can build your own levels. And there's a huge community of people of all ages who build these incredibly complicated sort of mini games. It's really, really amazing. Fantastic creativity. And it was really fun to be a part of that. I worked on a playset called Twilight of the Republic, which is based on the prequel trilogy and the Clone Wars cartoon series. And I also did some work on the Star Wars Rebels characters, writing dialogue for all these characters as they appear in the game. And it was... I had an absolute whale of a time, I've got to say. I work with a great studio here, a bunch of guys called Ninja Theory, based here in Cambridge. Really, really clever, really, really talented guys, fantastic game programmers. And it was amazing. I got to go out to Lucasfilm headquarters and in San Francisco and hang out with those guys and see loads of sort of preview stuff for Star Wars Rebels. And, you know, and that for me as a Star Wars fan was, it's kind of like, you know, the pilgrimage to the Holy Land of fandom, right? You know, and when we walked into the building, you know, there's props and stuff from all the different films, and you could not walk 2 feet without seeing something amazing. It's like, my God, that's the Ark of the Covenant. And look over there. There's a, you know, there's a Star Wars stormtrooper from 1977 from Tunisia, and here's R2-D2, and there's, like, you know, this prop from this movie and this prop from that film. And there's a lot of great, there's some Star Trek stuff in there as well, you know, because Industrial Light and Magical worked on, you know, some of those movies.
Oh, yeah.
Just seeing that stuff, it's like we were going to this meeting, and I kept stopping every couple of feet going, wow, look at that. And they're like, you know, you have got this meeting to go to, Mr. Swallow? Yeah, I'll be with you in a sec. I just want to look at this thing, you know, isn't that cool? And it's funny, one of the guys who worked there said to me, you can always tell someone who's, it's their first time, because they do exactly what you just did, which is just stop and go, oh, wow, you know. And so that was really amazing. And they're a super talented bunch of guys and very, very hot on, you know, what is and is not Star Wars. And it was a real pleasure to work with them. And I hope I get to do more stuff for them in the future.
It's funny because I was playing that game with my brother-in-law, and we were playing the Twilight of the Republic, because it's Star Wars and it's so much fun. And then I was thinking to myself, James Swallow wrote these lines that's awesome.
You know, one of the coolest moments, it's a small thing, but I really got this kind of amazing fanboy thrill out of it, was I had to sat down and I had, the first thing I had to do was write the opening text crawl that scrolls up the screen, you know? And I was like, oh my, I'm writing a Star Wars text crawl. And when the first time I saw it, you know, going up the screen with the music, and I was like, wow, you know, there's been a few times awesome. In my career when stuff, small little things like that have happened. I can remember the first time I got to write a line of dialogue for Spock. And it was the first time I'd ever written a TOS character. And I remember writing, it was in a Mirror Universe story I did for the Shards and Shadows anthology. And I wrote this line of dialogue and I kind of stopped and was like, wow, here's a character that has meant a lot to me all through the years and has given me a lot of enjoyment. And now I get to put words in his mouth and write a story about him. And it is fantastic. It's very rewarding to be able to, I guess, in a way, give something back to a fictional world that's given me so much enjoyment and pleasure over the years. So yeah, it was really, really great to work on Disney Infinity. And then beyond that, well, I have my next Star Trek novel is going to be coming out in February. And of course, next year, 50th anniversary. So it's a very big deal. I think I'm going to be the first TOS novel out of the gate next year. So I get to lead the charge. And just this week, I got to see the cover artwork for it. And it's very cool.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I'm really, really pleased about it. I think StarTrek.com are going to do like an exclusive cover reveal sometime soon. But it's really, really nice piece of artwork. Great, you know, great classic Starship style cover on the, you know. And that book's called The Latter Fire. And that's set in the last couple of years of the 5-year mission. So it's sort of at the end of the 3 years of the live action show, beginning of the 2 years of the animated series. So there's a kind of little bit of crossover going on there. And that was a lot of fun. That was me kind of, you know, ticking off a box on my writer to-do list, which is, you know, to write what I think of, you know, the classic era TOS story that has that kind of larger than life, brassy sort of fun action adventure stuff that to me was the classic Trek stuff that I grew up enjoying. So it's very much in the mold of, you know, the Doomsday Machine, the Immunity Syndrome, those kind of stories. And that was a lot of fun to do that as well. You know, I had a great time when I wrote one scene where Spock actually gives somebody a neck pinch and I was like, oh, I get to write a neck pinch scene. That's so cool. And it was something I hadn't even written it into my notes. And I was like, oh, I have to have this happen. How does that work? And I was like, oh, I can write a neck pinch scene. And it's not contrived. It actually makes sense. And that was really great to do that. I had a great time with that. And beyond that, a couple other video game projects, which I can't really talk much about. And next year, also releasing on the same day as The Latter Fire is Deus Ex Mankind Divided, which is the new video game in the Deus Ex series, which I also have been doing some writing on. And then beyond that, just a few other short story projects. But if, you know, as always, if you guys want to keep an eye on my Twitter feed and my social media pages, I will talk about everything I'm working on because, you know me, I'm super enthused about being a writer and I love talking about my work.
Yeah, why don't you let our listeners know what your Twitter handle is and where they can find you online?
You can always find me on Twitter at JM Swallow, where I attempt to be witty and clever and occasionally will post pictures of interesting things I've seen. I'm also on jamesswallow.blogspot.com, I think it is. You can find me there at that on my site. Again, don't post as much as I should do, but occasionally I put up stuff about new releases and sometimes run competitions and that kind of thing.
James, I love when you get to come on and talk Star Trek. It's always so much fun, and I really appreciate you being such a great friend to the show, too. I really wanted to thank you for the kind words you had for the network and the show and what you did for Christopher Jones in this book and giving him his own ship, which is awesome.
Very cool.
Making him a captain. So that kind of thing, it warms my heart when the authors do that kind of stuff. And you've been a really special friend to us. And I really just wanted to say thank you.
Well, thank you guys. I mean, I really appreciate it as well. You know, it's so rewarding to have people like you and all the other guys out there who do the podcasts and run the websites and stuff, because as writers, you know, we do what we do and we kind of shoot it off into the void and go, well, I wrote that. I think it's kind of cool. I hope people liked it, you know, and we don't really know it, but it's great to have the support of the fan base and to know that you guys enjoy what we do. Plus, the thing is, whenever I'm writing a crew for a ship and I always need people's names and I think, who's the, who to put down here, you know, I love listening to literary treks anyway, because, you know, it keeps me up to date on stuff that I haven't read And it's always fascinating to hear you guys, you know, picking over the minutia of these stories, because we listen, we pay attention, right? You know, when you guys when you guys say something like, kind of, oh, maybe this leads into this, you know, we're listening, going, hey, that's not a bad idea. Maybe I should do that thing. Or alternatively, we'll go, ah, oh, he's guessed. I've got to do something completely different.
Right? Well, hopefully that doesn't happen too often.
You know, oh my God, they've guessed the plot of the novel. It's like calling up the editor and saying, quick, send it back. We have to change everything. Stop the presses. Now, that hasn't happened yet, as far as I know. But yeah, it's so, you know, thank you to you guys on behalf of all of the writers. You know, it's always great to have the support of the fan base out there. And also to everybody who tunes in and listens and buys the book, you know, because at the end of the day, all of us who work on the books, we are all fans, you know, and we're lucky enough to kind of get to do this stuff for a living. And it's nice to know that the stories we write appeal to other people other than just ourselves, because we write stories that we want to see. I write the kind of stories that I like, and it's cool to know that other people like them too.
Well, very much so. Absolutely. And it's just always a pleasure to be able to talk to you guys and have you on the show. So it's really special to be able to do this, and we really thank you for that.
Well, thanks a lot. I would like to, you know, it's a shame really that here in the UK we don't get to do a lot of Star Trek conventions. We don't have hardly anywhere near as many of them as you guys do. I did do a really great convention this year, actually, earlier on, called First Contact Day with Una McCormack. And she and I are going to be going back and doing that again next year. And everybody's saying to me, come back to Shore Leave, come back and do Shore Leave next year. I did that a few years ago. And I would like to come back and do that again, just to kind of fly the flag for the British contingent.
Yeah, that would be great. In fact, I would love to get to Shore Leave sometime just because of the author contingency there. I'm always very disappointed that Star Trek Las Vegas does not have a better relationship with the Star Trek authors and has not made that a big deal, since it's, you know, one of the few properties that CBS is really carrying on right now. So
definitely,
I've got to get to Shore Leave sometime.
Yeah, let me just put that out there. Anybody, any American Star Trek conventions who would like a British Star Trek author to come to your convention, please call me.
Awesome. That's it. Every convention out there needs to be paying attention.
Absolutely.
Get James, because, yeah. Well, I mean, as getting to know you, we've talked so much about so much Star Trek, and you can talk any part of Star Trek, and I think that's what would make you great for any convention to have. So, guys out there, get James.
Thanks, boys.
Thanks, James.
Thanks.
Have
a
great night.
Cool.
Well, Matthew, I mean, we have been spoiled the last few weeks here, getting to talk to all these authors. And, you know, today's discussion with James Swallow, wow, what an awesome person to be able to talk to just about Star Trek in general and about his work in this really great Titan novel we got this month.
One of the things that I just... It always amazes me doing this show is the relationship that I've gotten to foster with the different authors. And James is so much fun. He's so effervescent when it comes to his love of Star Trek and his love of all things. I mean, James is one of those guys. He just loves all things geeky, you know. And so hearing him geek out about you know, getting to work on Star Wars too, you know, it's the joy of being part of this and being in fandom and all of fandom and just embracing it, you know. And I appreciate so much how all of these authors do that, and it's so much fun to just spend time with them and get to talk about their love and our love of all of these things geeky. And James does such a great job of pouring that into his books, and I think that's why there's never been a James Swallow book that I'm like, you know, not awesome. You know, James has really done a great job of keeping me engaged in all of his stories.
Yeah. Wouldn't you just love to spend an evening at the pub with him just talking about Star Trek? And, oh, man,
yep.
I could talk with him for hours. That was really great.
I definitely could as well. So... I'm so glad that James was here. I hope everybody enjoyed it. get in touch with us. Let us know what you think of the Titan series and the latest new Titan novel at trek.fm/contact. Of course, you can check up with us on Twitter at trekfm and Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And then the Babel Conference, great place to be. Just type Babel into the search field on Facebook. Go to the website at trek.fm and hit discussion on the menu bar, and you can get to the Babel Conference. And it's just a place for only listeners of Trek FM to get together. And then, of course, the Goodreads group. Go check out what we're going to be reading next, what's coming up, and everything we've done and all of the discussions going on over there. And again, you can find the Goodreads group. Just type Literary Treks into Goodreads, or you can go to our show page, any of the Literary Treks show pages, and you'll see the link there for Goodreads. Really want to say thank you to Will Wynn and Ken Tripp for their support and helping us bring Literary Treks to each week. And they do that as associate producers through Patreon. And Patreon is a really important thing for us here at the network. We're a listener-supported network. So we need the listeners to help us bring all of this content to you, whether it's the bandwidth we have, or all the downloads, all of the space that we have online that we have to host the shows. Of course, we've got all the things that we need financially to make sure that we bring you the best quality content out there for geekdom. And so just go to patreon.com/trekfm and see how you can be part of the team. And we love to give back to you for doing that. We've got exclusive content. You can get early access to content. And of course, you could also be in the Patreon roundtable as well with Will Wynn and other listeners talking about Star Trek, being on your own podcast every month. So we'd love to have you as part of the team. Again, go to patreon.com/trekfm. Guys, one of the things you can also do to really help the show and help it continue to grow and get bigger is that if you're an Apple user, hit that subscribe button. It does do something. It really helps us move up in the iTunes rankings, as well as those star ratings and reviews. I know you hear us say that all the time, but it really is true that it makes a huge difference. If you're not an Apple user, though, you can listen to us on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. You can go to the website at trek.fm and grab the MP3 file, or you can also grab the RSS link and put that into any podcatcher. So honestly, you can have Trek FM on the go all the time. Now, Dan, when you're not at home clutching your teddy bear, praying you don't get abducted late at night as you're trying to sleep, where can we find you?
Oh, well, Matthew, I mean, it is pretty dark and scary. And did you just hear a little bit of clicking over there? No, I think it was my imagination. You can find me online at www.treklit.com. That's my website where I review Star Trek novels, both old and new. I'm on Facebook at facebook.com/treklitreviews and on Twitter at treklitreviews, and my personal Twitter feed, which is at kertrats, K-E-R-T-R-A-T-S. And you can also find me on Instagram. I'm at kertrats47. Again, you know, I take some interesting pictures there. Not all of it's Star Trek, but sometimes some, you know, models that I'm working on or the Eagle Moss ships. So you can find some pretty interesting stuff on there. And Matthew, when you're not sitting in your quarters reading a book, looking warily at your replicator as though it might turn on you at any moment, where can we find you?
I don't want any more replicated death balls coming out of that thing. That is, I'm thinking about getting it removed from my quarters and just going down to the local replimat, because the thing freaks me out. When that's not happening, or I'm not tweeting about my fears, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. I try not to take pictures of scary things, but I'm on Instagram at MRushing. You can find me on The Orb with Christopher Jones, where we do talk about Deep Space Nine. That's the Deep Space Nine podcast here on the network. You can also find me on the 602 Club, like James, talking about things like Star Wars or any of the new things that have been coming out, like The Martian or Pan or things like that. New, old, everything in between we try to talk about on that show. And then, of course, you can also find me on my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And until next time, live long and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.